This is an interview with the Swedish Ambassador Rolf Ekéus to Washington. It's the 28th April, year 2000. And what was your exact role as Executive Chairman of the UN Special Commission?
It was to supervise the setting up of the organization, UNSCOM, to recruit personnel, to identify tasks, following the directives given in Resolution 687.
Yes.
I normally call the ceasefire resolution, because that resolution constitutes ceasefire after the war between Iraq and the coalition led by the United States.
Did your role turn out to be different than you expected when you first agreed to join UNSCOM? And did it change over the several years that you were executive chairman?
Yeah, yes, it did. Most of us, and including myself, thought that the task was a complex technical arms control hardware task.
Mm.
We didn't believe it should be politically complicated. And the reason was that the ceasefire resolution offered a deal to Iraq that on one side, if Iraq cooperated and came clean from all the weapons of mass destruction identified, nuclear weapons, biological weapons, chemical weapons, and missiles with a range of about 150 kilometers distance, if Iraq can flee, then the prohibition against export of all Iraqi oil, which had been put into place, that prohibition would no longer stay in force. And that we, in simple terms, if Iraq gave up its weapons, it would get its oil and the money it could generate for selling oil. So that was, to me, a very simple deal, considering that Iraq is one of the third or second or third largest oil exporters in the world. We talk about before the war, the Iraq was selling some 3.5 million barrels a day, which amounts to at least 18 billion dollars a year. So our idea was that Iraq would like to get these 15, 20 billion dollars, and the price for that was to give up the weapons. So I think that was the view of the Security Council members, and by me as the innocent opening up the, I felt the Iraq would be eager to cooperate. Iraq would be eager to get rid of it, and therefore when I recruited the staff and I structured the job, I focused upon having a good arms control and weapons, about weapons expertise employed in order to get the task quickly done, to help Iraqi people, to help Iraq out of this. However, it turned out the opposite, namely after a month or two, during our first or second visits to Baghdad in summer 1991, we started in 1991, it was clear that Iraq was misleading and giving false information, and even I would say lying about its capabilities. So then we were put in front of a totally new situation. It was no longer a technical threat.
What were the first signs that they were lying, not telling the truth?
The first sign came when we went in with our first chemical weapons team. That team went into Iraq in May. We had recruited international experts very quickly from our headquarters in New York. I went with the team in. I had worked in chemical weapons as the chairman of the International Association of Chemical Weapons in the 80s, so I had a certain experience, knowledge at least, abstract way about these issues, I was very curious. And when we went to the first known chemical weapons production facility installation in Mutana, Al Mutana, we saw outside the lab that they had been burning documents just before we arrived. There were fragments of massive paper burning. And that was at least a warning signal. I still didn't react completely, but to me it was peculiar. Why burn papers? Why don't allow us to look at them? So if they burned paper, was it to hide something? So at least I got warning signals.
But they didn't do that more carefully. I can't understand that.
They were desperate. They were under time pressure. Mm. It is not easy. So we put up also, some experts put ashes or paper fragments to conceal that relation to at least the chemical formula. Such advice, how to produce chemical weapons. So nothing special has been that they knew that Iraq had chemical weapons. Second time was in June when we sent a team, one of our first teams, to look at the nuclear together with the IAEA, National Atomic Energy Agency. It was a joint team. And there, the Iraqi side suddenly and dramatically blocked our experts wanted to be into a facility where we suspected that components for production of nuclear weapons were. We had good reason. We had some intelligence, when I say so afterwards, from satellite observations and so on, that guided us to go to that place. But the Iraqi side refused us entry. Our team entry, I wasn't there myself then, but the team was refused entry. I was in the headquarters and directing the team from there. The chief inspector, a man called David Kay, a very fine man, an energetic, dynamic man, he insisted anyhow to go in while they were, you know, quarreling at the entry to this big fenced-in facility. Two members of his team climbed up into a water tower at the end.
Oh yes, I heard about it.
And from the water tower they could see with their binoculars at the backside that trucks were leaving, a convoy of trucks were leaving the facility. So they threw themselves into, at that day, a sedans, old American sedans left from, you know, they had hired in Iraq. They had maybe to get in our more modern equipment. So jumping, you know, these big cars with weak suspension, they tried to catch up on these trucks, which was foolish, but very courageous. And to the mind, I meant the Iraqi nervousness was demonstrated at the vehicles in the end stopped and out ran personnel with guns and started to shooting at our inspector.
Actually?
Yes.
Sorry.
Jag visste, det ringde mig då och sa, vad ska vi göra? Jag sa, ja, stopp om och dra tillbaka. Jag vill ju inte ha några... Vill inte ha några av våra snälla experter, de här var inga soldater och
kommandogubbar.
Utan de var nukleära fysiker och sådär, så de var ju helt tokiga egentligen att ta den risken. Men så drog de tillbaka. Men det demonstrerade ju då tydligt att Irak verkligen... sorry.
It's okay.
So we start again, or you can maybe try.
Yeah, sure, I can.
No. That demonstrated, anyhow, that these, Iraq was extremely nervous for taking those extraordinary steps. And when David Kay called me or reported this event, the ongoing process, I ordered them immediately to withdraw because we didn't want them. They were not trained commander soldiers, they were, you know, middle-aged, nuclear scientist.
Sort of in the wrong situation there.
Yes, well, that was the question.
Yes.
I mean, so the conclusion was simply that Iraq obviously was hiding something, was not prepared to declare the exact content of its prohibited capability.
Well, yeah, obviously. Why do you think you got the job? What kind of experience did you have in the area before getting the assignment? We touched it a little bit, but maybe you could...
No, that was the broad answer to that is, again, that the Security Council was looking for someone with a combination of diplomatic experience, obviously, but with a special focus upon weapons issues, arms control, disarmament issues. And as no one will, so they were not looking upon an, I would say, an Arabist or a specialist in, say, the Arabic world or a specialist in the on the region and the region's problems. I had some, I would say, general knowledge, but my specialty was my experience in having been, first of all, as I indicated, chairman for the chemical weapons negotiations, international negotiations. I've been heavily involved in negotiations as a leader of the Swedish delegation, also as a leader of the so-called Group of 21, which was in the Conference on Disarmament. I was heavily involved in the Biological Weapons Convention because Sweden in the mid-80s, when I served as head of our delegation in Geneva, was aiming at strengthening the convention by adding rules for better verification, compliance and control arrangements. So we had a leadership role and were active in the debate and disputes around that.
But still at this time you had no idea about the biological weapon that Iraq will later on show.
No, we had none at that time, but to answer the question simply,
exactly.
That was the experience, and I also had some role in the related nuclear non-proliferation treaty, as I had served as chairman of the drafting committee in 1985 at the successful conference, review conference, one of the few successful conferences on the NPT. These were my credentials. And also there was another political element. Sweden was not a war-fighting partner of the coalition which defeated Iraq. So probably one saw it as an advantage to have someone from a neutral and non-belligerent in this case. Therefore logical, not many left. I was one of the few who both came from the country and had that experience.
That's great. But were you at all able to prepare yourself for this specifically?
I was asked very quickly by the Secretary General through the Swedish government, and I accepted after very short hesitation. I thought this as a very quick job. I saw it as a tailor-made, as I indicated in the first question. I thought this was a fascinating technical job, but not long winding, not a diplomatic, not a security issue. I saw it as a... So I felt this would... I had re-adequate knowledge, basic knowledge, and now it was just to read myself into the text. So I rushed into the job. As I was indicated, we felt, both in the Security Council and myself individually, that here we had this deal, weapons oil, and the longer we delayed the law, more money Iraq would lose. With the present export Iraq could have of oil, say they would earn $30 million a day. Now they had an embargo on $30 million. So I felt if I kept away my taking up the job, say 2 days, that would mean that Iraq had lost $60 million in 2 days. I couldn't take that on my conscience, so I rushed to start as quickly as possible. So that is a little it was on the job learning, in other words.
Incredible. How did you manage to keep Anscombe independent, and why was Anscombe's independence so important?
The resolution, first of all, the Security Council decided when Anscombe was set up that it should be financed not from UN ordinary budget, but by money generated first in the beginning by voluntary contributions back then. Secondly, by taking frozen Iraqi assets, Iraqi money in banks all over the world, which had been frozen in connection with Iraq's attack on Kuwait. So these frozen assets were declared should be used to finance our operations. The reason why the Council did not want to have the General Assembly involved was that, I take it the US especially, the United States, the leader, but also some of the others didn't want to have the question politicized, because if it's the UN finance, that is the General Assembly which decides, and the process is there with whether the advisory budgetary committee, with a special fifth committee dealing with administration and funding, and the General Assembly. That would be cumbersome. This was the ceasefire after the war. Why should the General Assembly be involved? So the idea was to keep UNSCOM clean, and that meant also that the General Assembly, all the UN states, could not poke their nose into the task, give directives to UNSCOM and say it should deploy that type of people, that type of people. So it gave the freedom from involvement from the General Assembly. That was the most important thing. Secondly, it was important also that UNSCOM could be free to report directly to the Security Council and not necessarily go through the General Secretary General. Formally it reported through the Secretary General, but not in practice, because it was sensed that the Secretary General would have to take political considerations, soften up and change the quality of the reporting.
Wasn't the reporting sort of like 2 times a year or something?
Yes.
And to Maine?
Yes, it was the Maine target to report twice, 2 times a year, formally. Obviously, between, if there were emergencies to report.
Do you think that if the IAEA, how do you pronounce it?
Yes, IAEA.
Yes. If they would have been more independent, do you think that they would have been able to manage the situation better than they did?
I think they were. Even there, it was a special setup. The resolution, ceasefire resolution 67, did not say that IAEA should deal with it as an organization. They said that the director general of the IAEA. And again, I believe the thinking was the governing council of the IAEA and its governing and the general body should not involve itself into running. It should be the expertise and technique of IAEA should be applied, but not its political decision making. So that's why it said Director General, and all Director General also at that time, Hans Blix, set up a special action team, which was not directed by the governing board body or the governing board of the IES. There was an effort to keep it in. I don't think that was a problem for IES.
Okay. You think so? Do you want to?
No, yeah, they will bring some. We have it 10 o'clock.
Yes, I know. Do you think that UNSCAM lost some of its independence later on in the process?
No, later on maybe. My effort was to keep all Security Council members involved so they knew what was going on, and especially permanent members, because this was big power game. But you should be fair, so all council members should know. However, and in that sense, it was a delicate balance to keep them involved, keep them informed. They hated to be surprised, and they were even more upset if they had to read about the problem in the newspapers before it was reported to them. I went at considerable length to prevent such things. I always kept them informed in advance, even bad news, to warn them about it. So that was one side of the coin, so keep them involved. But when they came with advice, individual members, they could be US, could be Russia, could be any of the five. Mm. So you should do this and you should do that. I listened to all this, I liked advice, but I didn't say that I followed their advice if I didn't find it good.
Yeah.
I said, if you want to force me to do something, then you have to take a joint decision according to your rules. You have to put the decision in place.
And not come individually.
Or a statement, joint around the statement by the president, so all 15 should be involved. If they could, then I was obviously obliged to follow what they were saying, and I would do it happily. However, I always defended the independence of the commission. Later on, I don't know, after I left 97, there became a lot of controversies turned out, and at least my successor was accused of taking too much advice from the United States government. The others were unhappy with that. Yes. But it's difficult to put a judgment on that.
Yeah.
But they will put his own presentation in the book, so we will see how he explains this and how he answers that question.
Okay.
But we were never, I mean, we had good cooperation, but we never accepted to bow to their proposals. If they were stupid, we didn't follow their good proposals, but we were grateful. Good advice is worth much.
That's good, so you weren't obliged to. Would it also have made could you describe your relationship initially with IAEA? And did that change, and if so, how?
Well, yes, what there were two philosophies colliding when we started. That's my impression now. Namely, I felt that we had to take it as a starting proposition after the event I described before, that Iraq was systematic hiding, misleading about its capabilities, and that Iraq therefore was obliged to come clean. It was the burden of proof was on Iraq. I could say that we considered Iraq guilty until we had proven it innocent.
Okay.
The IAEA proposed approach was linked to IEA's old culture, which has to deal with long cooperation, a friendly, supporting cooperation with their member governments. So the IEA idea was a more classical one.
Obviously more trusting each other.
Yes, saying innocent until one could prove they were guilty. So this was two different philosophies. And I think that created some problems in the beginning. IEA also was anxious to keep its independence from UNSCOM. UNSCOM was, as you know, tasked to give support and advice to the IEA, and also had some other responsibilities in the nuclear field, even if IEA was in the driver's seat on nuclear issues, while UNSCOM was alone, of course, responsible for the weapons and for missiles. But UNSCOM had also responsibility in the nuclear. So it was a little problematic in the beginning because our more suspicious attitude.
Not wrong, yes.
No, I think we have.
Okay.
I promised Helena she wanted to listen to that interview on the, it's about the London Kärnvapen conference in New York.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, do you want to take a break?
So we take a break.
How was it that Iraq was able to develop weapons of mass destruction to the extent it did without anyone doing anything before they did?
First of all, they had the capability through money, because of the oil exports, they had plenty of money. During the war with Iran, the 8-year war, unfortunately, West, for political reasons, were supporting Iraq discreetly, because the West was very much against the fundamentalist rule in Iran, and that opened up for export of high quality technology and of also expertise, advice, and from the advanced industrial countries. So there were, but it was done in a very clever fashion. It was hidden inside so-called civilian programs, and so there were two technical things that made possible. One technical thing, I mean, that was a systematic effort to provide alternative stories. Say, if you import chemicals for production chemical weapons, you said this import is for producing pesticides and fertilizers for the agriculture.
You mean that they used the imported things for that could look like it had dual issues?
Exactly.
But do you mean that the Western countries actually knew about this and just sort of, you know, looked, took their fingers and said, okay, that's not doing it?
We have to recall that there was plenty of money involved here, and the West suspected, I'm quite sure. I think even we in Sweden had our, we were not heavily involved, I have to say. But most of us had suspicions. And the suspicion was clear when Iraq used actively chemical weapons against Iran and against its own population. So also toward the end of the war, in the end of the 80s, there was an improvement, especially on missile technology, which had been flowing quite generously towards Iraq. So there was a sharpening. But anyhow, it was unfortunate political overlooking to the serious attention of the leadership.
What criteria would determine the decision to carry out an inspection? And had you ever carried out similar inspections previously? Had the IAEA, as you say, or any organization carried out inspections in the way UNSCOM did before?
No, this was totally new methods which were applied here. And the First of all, there were two types of inspection. One could say the more soft type, which were more to identify Iraq's production capability in general industrial capability, chemical, pharmaceutical, veterinarian, was very lot of poison produced in that area. So one, that was, one could say, mapping out the Iraq's capability. However, in this process of establishing base knowledge, base under basic understanding of Iraq's capabilities, the inspectors, because of their quality and the brilliance, skilled scientists, detected things which didn't fit the overall picture, anomalies of various sorts. And that gave signal to back to the headquarters that we had to do something else. And there we used, these findings were analyzed very carefully and led to that one, that the UNSCOM established more pointed inspections to suspect facilities.
You see, more direct.
So it was it was generated inside the process of mapping Iraq. These anomalies helped to point direction for the inspection. Secondly, we established very early on systematic overflights, or we had the so-called high-altitude reconnaissance plane.
Is that the U-2 plane?
The U-2 plane. Mm. Press, they call it spy plane, but I didn't like that because we had the right to carry out this inspection under the resolution. But these U-2 turned out to be of highest value. We had our own leased U-2 from the United States, I have to say. So it was flown by an American pilot, but the pilot was formally under command of UNSCOM. That was important. If it had been shot down, he would be arrested and hanged as a spy. If it had not been, but now he was under, if it had been considered an American operation. But now it was a UN operation, so he was protected by that. This imagery from the missions, which took place roughly once or twice per week, gave the analysts in UNSCOM, the photo analysts and the specialists, signals. You could see a factory where some new ventilation system was added to the roof. Why do they need a new ventilation system? Maybe it's a more advanced activity going on. Or we could see an inordinate amount of heavy trucking going to some place. Why that? And then we could target our inspection team to go to these places.
According to the photos that the U-2 planes took?
Yes. And we also had this helicopters inside the country, which was stationed in the first run by the Germans for us, and later on in Chile. And these helicopters could go out and take close range photography and look closely upon what had been detected by the U-2. That made us very effective. We could reach a lot of places very, very quickly and surprisingly. And I would say in 90% of the cases it was purely innocent, natural, civilian activities when we looked at it closer. But in 10% there were serious matters. So, and also it is well known now that obviously we established contacts with foreign intelligence services and asked them to provide us with information. And that information was added into the pictures, into our own findings, that, putting all these data together, then we decided where to go. So it was an active, dynamic search for even the classical safeguard inspection by the IAEA, to take the second part of your question. These were aiming at visiting facilities which had been declared by the country concerned, in this case Iraq. Mm-hmm. So it was only declared facilities visited. That was a country. Saddam decided to the which facility are they allowed to visit, and he said, "You're welcome there."
And of course, they were cleaned up.
And secondly, they should give a ample notice, weeks in advance. They should be the inspectors should be scrutinized and accepted by Iraq before they could go in. That they were the right nationality and not unsympathetic to Iraq. ONSCOM had none of this. We could went in without screening or other respect. We decided to go to both declared, but first of all to non-declared suspects.
Could I ask you about the U-2 planes? From where did they fly? Did they fly from the United States, or were they located somewhere else?
No, we had fortunately an arrangement with Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
So they were stationed in Saudi Arabia, and we notified Iraq about their flying in. We didn't want an accident, so we gave Iraq some days. From my office, we notified Iraq saying, in 2 days' time, you two will fly in within a certain window of time.
Okay.
So we gave them 14 hours or so. And with them, we also told Iraq of the entry point, the point where the flight should enter Iraq, and we told it where it should leave Iraq in order to not give Iraq any reason to attack. But we did not tell them how it should fly inside, which were the targets.
Did ever anything happen?
Well, we had some. Our rule was that we notified Iraq, and we demanded from Iraq's side that Iraq should accept formally the notification.
Mm.
There was assurance to our pilot and to our plane. And it happened at some occasion, but rarely, that Iraq did not accept the notification. Then we came into a very dramatic situation, because the United States government was not prepared to allow its plane to fly in without protection from so-called combat air patrol, and that meant a very heavy military umbrella would be established over Iraq. So or we should cancel. But if you cancelled such a trip, that would mean that Iraq, just by not accepting the notification, could stop all the other flights. So we couldn't take that line. But there were some nervous moments when that happened sometimes.
What was the toughest part of your job personally? Was it the work directly, or was it the insecure and unstable situation you were in? Was your job frustrating?
It was not frustrating in the sense that the job as such was, the contrary, it was extremely fascinating, stimulating, because it was like a puzzle, a very complex puzzle, and where you could play all your means against a very shrewd opponent. The Iraqi technique was to the refined method to hide, to mislead, to also frighten the opponent, threaten the opponent, that was us. But in a sense, that was in a certain adrenaline run when you had these tremendous stresses and challenges. No, the frustrating thing was the sense that this could be, this kept the Iraqi people under such hardship. When we knew that the answer for them would have been that Iraq just gave up these weapons, and no one should have such weapons anyhow. The great powers have some of them, but no one should have chemical weapons, no one should have biological weapons, because any nuclear is limited set of states, as we know. And say major powers like Germany, Japan, Italy, Brazil, Argentina, and say the Nordic countries, we have said we shall not have nuclear weapons. There is no reason why we should allow Iraq. So, but unfortunately, that was frustrating, that they insisted to try to trick us. Mm. And sometimes I felt a little angry. They said, do they believe that I am so stupid so they can trick me? When this is a game which will hurt their own people. Mm. Because if we could clean up these weapons, we could guarantee...
be better for everyone.
Yes, lifting of sanctions, relief in every aspect.
Was it difficult to work in this unstable situation, insecure situation that you actually were in?
Well, there were times where there were threats against our personnel. Frequently, they were frequently harassed, shot at. One favorite thing was to drive up against our vehicles when our inspectors were traveling. But it was not systematic. It was came and went in short periods of time. There were the same thing with my personal security. That was the barrage of attacks in Iraqi media.
I was going to ask if you could tell us about a little bit.
Well, I mean, they went at great length. For a while, the son of Saddam Hussein, Uday, he had his own newspaper, and he
still has, right?
Yes,
I think
he still has
journalism.
And when he wrote about me, he always added the prefix of the damned chaos, even if it was a pure technical. Next week, the damned chaos will arrive in Iraq. Not referring to any special statement or anything. That set, so to say, a pattern. It then was supported by very aggressive accusations about my responsibility for the suffering of Iraqi people. And also there was a tribunal set up, I think, which was run in Spain but inspired by Iraq, accusing me, and I think it was I was one, I think, President Bush for committing crime against international law in our policy on starving the Iraqi children. So that type of psychological warfare was disturbing. Then, through counterintelligence, of course, at repeated occasions, it was picked up. The signals which indicated that there were preparations to eliminate me under certain circumstances. But that was preparation, and I was, of course, concerned to some degree, but I also felt it was politically very unwise of them to do it. So I also felt that there was a certain guarantee in that it was not in Iraq's own interest to do it. I think it is maybe more a sort of psychological warfare to terrorize me and to get me more humble and cautious, friendly. Also there were threats, rumors, even information, intelligence information about decision to, or at least discussion about poisoning me, and so on and so forth. At one occasion it was a certain poison mentioned, and I asked my biological weapons expert, how does it affect you? Well, he said it will kill you, but first happens it turns your hair white.
And it's already white.
So, I said, that was interesting.
Maybe you already had some of it.
Yes. But I don't think the government or really seriously, I don't believe that it is serious attempt to it. I had also very, I mean, working and in positive to some degree within limits relationship with the top man on this side, namely the Deputy Prime Minister. We had a very good dialogue, and I think a sort of, we didn't agree with our basic tasks. I didn't agree with his task to hide and mislead us, and he didn't agree with my task to find out. But I think we respected each other and I think try to be fair to each other. And I think that was also a certain protection again. Mm. The final observation of that was, however, there is a risk to whip up hatred in press and media against someone, because there could be so that an individual would act on his own without government approval. So it was an unnecessary and irresponsible behavior.
Some comments on that one. The inspections and the work you and your team did took a very long time and was a very slow process. What was the most frustrating thing with the work you did? We talked a little bit about what you thought was frustrating, but like in the terms of the work, I know that they made it so difficult for you because they kept everything mobile, they kept moving everything.
Exactly.
Is that an issue?
That was the really, especially towards the end. In the beginning we had, I think, considerable success in identifying